rewrite. We fail. We rewrite. We refail. We hit delete. We weep. We write again. We hope. We fail again. And so turns the wheel of our destiny. For we are the warriors of words, the troopers of tenacity, the purveyors of perseverance. We are the failing writers.
Well, we've got a fantastic interview today with Evan S. Smith, who is hopefully going to help us move our Poker Night sitcom thing along a bit.
Because we need help. We need to get this moving.
We do.
Times are wasting.
We're doing that thing, aren't we? The deadline's getting closer now. We're like, oh, right, yeah, actually, we probably should.
We have done a bit of work on it.
Yep. But let's find out if it's actually a good idea when writing a sitcom to talk to somebody who's an expert in writing sitcoms. I don't know how this might turn out. Yeah. I'm not sure.
Before we do that, we should remind people that we have a competition ongoing.
Bloody
which
hell.
I'm sure everyone is very aware of.
I don't think you could have escaped it. If you've been living on the planet Earth for the last couple of weeks, you would be aware that our second annual Failing Writers Writing Competition is currently live. The entries are flying in.
Yeah.
And last time I said that, we hadn't had any. But this time, we have actually had loads.
Loads, yeah.
Yeah.
We have. We've got a steady stream, haven't we?
Yeah.
I've been enjoying reading them. They're all very different as well, like last time.
Yeah, it's good, though, isn't it? When you kind of feel as if you're really getting like some personalities of the writers through, or do you know, and they're kind of like a different, completely different take on
and
it.
And do remember, they don't have to be love stories, as in like romances, although some of these are, and they're very good. But it's loosely love stories. So it's a 500-word love story competition in association with the lovely people at Scrivener.
Aren't they lovely? Aren't they lovely people? They are lovely.
Yeah. And it's also free to enter. And there's actual prize money up for grabs.
Yeah.
I don't think we mentioned that.
£300.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have a think about that.
Go away. Have a good long think.
Get writing and enter. Hey? But while you do, we're going to have a chat with Evan S. Smith, who is a guy that has written on a lot of sitcoms and comedy projects. And he came to our attention because he wrote Writing Television Sitcoms, a book about writing television sitcoms.
Yeah, which I never would have guessed that. But,
thanks for clarifying.
Could come in useful. Could come in useful for the fact that we are trying to write a television sitcom.
Television sitcom.
Let's find out.
Have a chat with Evan.
Evan S. Smith, welcome to the Failing Writers Podcast. When you come on this show, you automatically become an honorary failing writer. So just embrace it. It hurts to begin with.
I'm glad to see that's the direction my career is now taking because they agreed to do a podcast. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
No, you are certainly not a failing writer because you've written plenty in your time, including the book Writing Television Sitcoms, which we've actually mentioned on the podcast. We've mentioned on
Where
the podcast
did we mention
before.
It, John? Oh, yeah, on the podcast.
By the way, but before we get into the nitty gritty of writing situation comedy, could you kick us off by telling us how it all started for you and how you got into the screenwriting industry?
Sure. You know, when I went to college, I thought, well, I probably want to be a doctor or an engineer, maybe an architect. You know, a bunch of stuff that was safe and smart, and that made my parents happy. And then in college, I kept taking courses in writing and theater, and that was the stuff I really enjoyed. And I wrote a play in my senior year of college that was selected for performance at the university I went to, and that was just a great experience. You know, when you have a really good experience, that sometimes that can launch you. So I, you know, sitting through the performances, and every performance, I would hear people laugh and I would hear people cry. So I'm like, that's good. That's a good sign.
A reaction.
Yeah. And I also did an internship in my senior year at a local TV station. And my university didn't even acknowledge the value of the internship. They wouldn't give me credit for it because at Brown University, which in the States is one of our Ivy League schools, and they were above TV.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So TV just isn't important.
Yeah. Enough. Well, now they have courses in it, right? So, but back then, no.
You're ahead of your time in that sense.
I don't know. There was I don't know that I can claim that, Dave. But I did the internship for no credit, And because I'm like, you know, I have an interest, career interest in this. Let's try it. So anyway, my senior year, I did not know what the hell I wanted to do. So I considered law school. I took the law boards, but they went down. I did really well on the law boards, but then I went to watch a trial downtown in Providence, Rhode Island. And it was a judge humiliating an ill-prepared lawyer. And I thought, that does not look like a lot of fun. So, let's cross the law thing off the list. So I thought of going to LA to be a starving writer, work at a McDonald's and write and try to, or go to grad school. Mm. Now for grad school, and I'm a professor now, right? My attitude was this, I'm not sure I want to try and be a writer or even get into the business. So I'll go to grad school for a semester, maybe two. And if I don't really catch fire with this, I'm out. I'll just drop out. You know, why am I going to spend all that extra time in grad school? Because I'm a big believer that time is the most important thing we have.
Yeah.
You know, so I, you know, hugely. And as I get older, I believe that more and more. Anyway.
Yeah, definitely.
So I ended up going to grad school. Actually, I came to grad school at the place I teach. Yeah. It's the Newhouse School at Syracuse University. I also applied to, you know, UCLA, USC, NYU, but this school has a one-year master's program. And I thought, that sounds really good to me. So I came here, I got the bug, I immersed in TV and film, I discovered that I really do like it. And so I decided, I'll complete the degree because the school is good. And then I will go to LA and see what I can do. So those are the early years. By now you're probably nodding off. You're like, why did we ask him this question? but you did. So I'm running with it. So I was very fortunate. CBS, the CBS television network that year went to 7 or 8 schools across the country, like NYU, UCLA, our school, and others, looking for the next Fred Silverman. Now, you guys are too young to remember this, but in his day, Fred Silverman was an American programming executive who changed the face of TV. And CBS was looking for the next him at these top schools.
Right.
And they ended up hiring 4 of us. And so that was a great experience. So you're like, he's not talking about writing. No, I'll get that.
So what were they hiring you as?
As a programming executive in the CBS television network, which was a great job.
Yeah.
So I went straight from college to being put up at the Dorset Hotel in Manhattan for 2 months and working at CBS BlackRock headquarters in Midtown Manhattan.
Wow.
And then they flew me out to Los Angeles and I worked out at TV City in Los Angeles. So it was a great introduction.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good.
Now here's where writing connects. When I interviewed for the CBS job while a student, at the end of the interview, I handed the executive a script that I'd written in a class. It was a sitcom script. And they told me later they loved it and they hired me because they figured if I could write it, I could supervise it. And then later in my career, I was a development executive. I ended up going, so I was in New York and then Los Angeles. Then I had to move back to New York because my father got really sick and I had to help run the family business for a bit. Settled back in New York. And another script I wrote for the original Magnum PI series, so that one got me interviews and that one got me my next program development job. So I was a TV development executive for about 6 years, I guess, in New York and LA. And let me see, New York, LA, then New York, and then back to LA. And then I quit because I wanted to be a writer.
Yeah.
I got tired of sitting in meetings where I thought I could do a better job on the script than the person I was giving notes to.
Yeah.
I see. So a development exec is effectively overseeing the development of
Here's what it is. You are looking for projects for whatever type of show your company wants to develop. When I was working for CBS, I was actually training in different departments when my father suddenly got ill and I literally had to hop on a plane that night and that ended up killing the CBS job. But when I was employed in my next job, I was employed by an ad agency that had a TV department that produced 3 of the top American soap operas, the daytime soap operas, but we also produced nighttime TV specials and movies.
Right.
And so I was hired to develop those. So a development executive, you take pitches from writers, producers, and directors. Mm. You're reading material. You're talking to people. You're networking. You're looking for the next great projects, and you're competing against other development executives in town to work with that talent or find that project.
Yeah.
And then once you find the project, then you have to convince the money people to support it. Then you have to sell it to the network, because when I went from CBS to this agency, we might find a project. We still had to convince CBS or ABC or NBC to, you know, to take it, to air it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they've got to worry about their schedule. So I was a development executive, including becoming a vice president for 5 or 6 years. And then I quit because I knew if I didn't quit then and try and write, I never would do it. And it drove my father almost had a heart attack. He's like, give it another 2 years. Cause I had an expense account, a nice office in Manhattan, you know? And I'm like, no,
sounds pretty cushy.
But you know what? I hated Sunday nights, because Sunday night,
right. Yeah,
it was
yeah.
like, I did not want to wake up Monday morning and go to my plush office to be a development executive.
The dreaded Sundayitis.
Yeah. Have you guys experienced it? You know what I'm talking about.
I've had a bit of that in the past. Yeah.
I used to get it when I was a kid. About school, so whenever I heard the theme tune to Antiques Roadshow, that was like a Pavlov's dog moment.
Yeah,
just sheer panic and
it triggers a pathological response, and it's not good.
No,
when I would go on a business trip as an executive and fly back into Manhattan, and we'd be coming into Kennedy or something or LaGuardia, and I would see the skyline of New York City, which is an amazing sight, I would not be happy because I was like, I don't want to go back to this job anyway. So I quit to become a writer. Proceeded to be out of work for at least a year. And, you know, I knew people in the business. I was having lots of meetings. I was not getting work, and finally started to get work. Here's a writing tip. Well, maybe it doesn't apply to anybody but me, but what the hell?
We'll take anything.
Yeah, this is digital media, so you can just delete all the stuff that I'm finding so amusing and wonderful and that has no place on your podcast. Just delete it. But, what the hell I was going to say. Okay, now here it is. So here's how stupid I am. So I've been a successful development executive, right? And then I quit to become a writer, most particularly a comedy writer. So I would go into pitch meetings and I'd wear a sport coat and you know, not a tie, but a sport coat. And when I talked to the producers about the gig and this and that, and maybe someone would mention, oh yeah, the show's supervised by this executive at NBC or at CBS, whatever. And I'd be like, oh yeah, I know Bruce. He just had a baby. And, you know, here I thought I was connecting and bonding with these people by saying that, and inside these producers are saying to themselves, oh God, the last thing we want in our shop is a writer who has a better relationship with an executive who supervises us than we do. So I wasn't getting the gig. And a writer friend, he was like, because he had read some of my stuff. He's like, Evan, I don't get it. You're getting the meetings, but you're not getting the jobs. What is it? What do you do? And I explained it to him. And he said, you're an asshole. Can I say that on the podcast?
You can't say asshole.
Get away with that.
Okay. He said, I was going to say, you're an idiot, but this is an English show. So he said, you're adult. How about that? You're adult. And he said, you know, you're scaring these people. You know, what are you thinking? They're looking to hire a low-level writer breaking into the writing end of the business, not an executive that's going to be having lunch with the person who supervises their show. And I said, you're right. So I dumbed down my wardrobe to, you know, jeans and sneakers and comfortable shirts. Yeah. Now, it's Hollywood. So they were expensive jeans and expensive sneakers, right? But you know, I brought it down and I changed my pitch. And then I started to get work as a writer. And most of the gigs I wrote were not produced. So I was paid to write the script, but so many shows in LA and New York are developed and they never air.
Yeah, yeah.
Or there's produced.
Yeah.
It's huge. So, you know, I made a decent living for a while getting jobs but not having them produced, and you know, that's not bad.
Is that just soul crushing, or is that something you can do?
No, when you're cashing the check and paying the rent,
that's all right.
It feels pretty good.
Like
if a show didn't go, it wasn't because of my script, it was because the producers didn't bring it when they needed to, or the politics of the place that was financing the show, or the network needs, the scheduling needs of the network that was buying the show.
But definitely not your script.
Definitely not, because Yeah. Let's just speak the obvious. Of course, nothing to do with me. So then I started to get work and was on the staff of a show and you know, it was great. But, and this is the weird thing. So I did that for 9 or 10 years and that was great. But I reached a point where I kind of went from, I had a crazy deadline and I had to get a script in on time. And then I might be out of work for 3 weeks or 2 months. And then I had the next crazy deadline. And I wasn't wild about it.
Yeah.
And my wife wasn't wild about living in Los Angeles. So what do you do? Well, at one point, the American Film Institute asked me to teach a workshop on comedy writing, a weekend workshop. So, yeah. And I'm like, you know what? I'm not a teacher, but this would be a smart way for me to organize my thinking about the work that I do. So yeah, I'll do that. You know, it's right. Let me see if I can learn from me.
Yeah.
And so I put together, cause I'm anal retentive like any good writer. So I put together basically notes for two full, I mean, it's 7 hours a day for 2 days and then with a lunch, with some breaks. Mm. But so I organized everything. I went in, I think I had like 40 pages of notes and I did it and it was fantastic. Partly because everybody in that audience had paid, I don't know, back then $150 to take the course.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that was a lot of money back then. And they were all into it. There were people who worked as professionals in the industry, you know, an assistant director of movies wanted to write comedy, you know, and stuff like that. But here was the cool thing. We had the classes were very interactive. We went through the whole class. At the end of each day, we'd finish the class. And then we'd end up hanging around and talking, me and 50 or 70 people talking for an hour after the class. And and it was just great. So I got home at the end of the weekend, my voice was shot. And I just told my, I don't know if she was my wife or my girlfriend there, some woman, there was a woman in my place.
Yeah, it had been a long weekend. There was a woman there when
it
you got
been,
home.
No, you know, it's like, I don't know. But it probably was in the wrong apartment. Hi, how you doing? I had a great weekend. Get out of my apartment. I don't know, you know. So, but I said, that was great. I really just had a really good time. And, but I'm not ready to quit being a writer now.
Yeah.
But let me file this away and maybe down the road. And in fact, so that's what happened. So I did some more stuff and then I realized, I'm like, you know what? This is cool. But that teaching thing. Oh, and AFI kept having me do workshops for them and stuff. And I just really, it's just fun. It's fun to do, but it's also fun to share and connect with people. It's not just you and your cat named Junior in your office at your home trying to come up with the second act.
Yeah.
You know?
I guess it's the thing. If you're teaching people or talking to people who they've paid money, they want to be there, they want to do this sort of thing, it makes a big difference to say a regular teacher who's trying to teach people who would rather be anywhere else but there at that point.
You're absolutely right, Dave. And in fact, I recognized that then. And I'm like, you know what? I may have just enjoyed a special circumstance. And this, I don't want to make the wrong decision based on that. So later, I taught for a semester at Cal State Fullerton, California State Fullerton, a mid-level quality school in the area. Well, don't tell them I said that about them. So I spoke to the chair of the department and I'm like, hey, you know, do you ever need people or whatever? He's like, well, who are you? And I described my credentials. And so I ended up teaching like their screenwriting course, two screenwriting courses, or was it a screenwriting and production course? I can't remember, that fall for just one semester. But I just wanted a taste of what it really was like, not the AFI experience. And it was still good. Mm. Here's the difference, Dave. In the true college experience, some of the students were totally 9-to-5 students. At 5:05, they had to be at the local McDonald's earning some money. And they were not invested in their education. Yeah. You would have some who were, many who weren't. But what worked for me and excited me was that as the course developed, I was able to get the less invested to become invested.
Yeah.
You know, at least a higher level.
Yeah.
So, you know, I kind of believe in karma, where if you work hard for stuff and you're sincere, karma generally tries to throw you a bone. And I think karma throwing me and AFI students who were so serious and invested, and karma throwing me a successful test run at Cal State Fullerton was very helpful to me in terms of like, yeah, okay, this is what I want to do next when I'm ready to do.
Yeah. So did that course kind of effectively become the book or part of it?
You know, that's a very good question, John. I can see why you're in charge of the other two guys. Very smart. So it was the germ of it, the AFI thing. And then I did refine that when I did other AFI comedy workshops, and very smart. That actually became the heart of a later version of that class that I taught, which is, you know, the premise-driven comedy approach that I take, which is, you know, you figure out this, you know, you got to find, develop a story that has comedy laced into the overall story. You know, if you do that, by the time you get to working on the outline, working on the script, it's all just sitting there waiting for you. You know, it's not just, oh, I have a dramatic script that's not funny. Let me just force some jokes on you. Because then you get comedy that feels like, in the 1980s, there were a lot of American sitcoms that were just joke. And there were decent jokes out of context, but they were painful shows to watch because the comedy did not come from the story, did not come from the character. And that's what you need. You need the comedy to be organic and to feel natural.
Yeah.
And that's when, like many of your best lines, out of context, they're not funny. But when spoken by this character that has this history in this arena, that line kills.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen a series, an American series called Veep?
Yeah,
Veep. Veep. Yeah.
Okay, all right. That show is, except for the last year, which, you know, that show is a great example. If you look at a lot of the lines, if you pulled them from scripts for the episode, you'd be like, out of context, the setup and the payoff are not that funny.
Yeah.
But when presented by the characters we'd come to know and love, and the actors were so talented at pulling jokes out of that stuff, it worked.
Yeah.
I mean, oh man, who's the actress who's just the star of Veep? I'm blanking on her. Julianne Dreyfus.
Is it Julianne Dreyfus?
Yeah. Yes. From
Seinfeld.
Yeah, yeah. Seinfeld. Absolutely. Well, you know who else was really a great example of being able to pull laughs from an artfully written but not funny out of context line was the actor who played Gary. A lot of his lines, you know, you need to hear Gary saying them in order to get the joke. So anyway,
yeah, he's a great actor. Actually.
Yeah, but well, we had one of the writers of that on, didn't we? David Kontick.
Yeah,
wrote for that show, and we had.
How did that go?
Good. I think it was good. He doesn't give much away, does he, Mr. Quantic? But
No, but it's very funny. Yeah, very funny, man.
Very dry. Well,
let's talk about that episode for the rest of this time, because maybe we can open it up a bit and add some stuff to what he should have said. I'm incorrigible. I'm just from your emails, I thought be fun talking to these guys, so I'm in, let's do it. So
that's how we lure people in.
and then
it's a heavy edit,
then they come to find out we're very dark and despairing and just not fun at all.
I like what you're saying there. I think a lot of the writing of sitcoms is partly trying to get people to invest in the characters, because once you've got people, I think that's the key, isn't it?
I talk a lot about character appeal with my students and consulting clients and stuff. If an audience has come to really be invested in and care for your character or be interested in your character, they will forgive an occasional gap in story logic or an occasional weak story, because they're just, you know, there's a new series on in this country called She-Hulk. Do you have that?
I've not heard of that.
Oh, it's on Disney, I think, isn't it? She-Hulk.
Oh, yeah. I think my son's watching that. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So it's like, that's an example. And don't tell anybody at Disney I said this, but I couldn't wait to see that show, because they had a great, one of the best lines or responses from the lead actors in a promo. And I'm like, oh, that looks really good. And it is a fun show. It's an interesting show. But that's a show where much of the appeal is the lead actress. And I'm sorry, I don't know her name yet. It hasn't stuck, but she just is. Some people are just interesting to watch. You know, they're just on a screen, and you want to know what's in their head, and you're looking forward to that. And she's that. She's at this point, the stories are fine, the jokes are slight. She's better than the jokes, and so we're gonna watch episode 3 to see if it picks up and so on. But that's an example.
Yeah, because you get those people in life as well, don't you? People you just happen to find really funny. Everything they say, even if it's not a particularly funny thing, it's just funny if it comes from them.
Right.
And I guess if you can build a character like that, then you're onto a winner.
Yeah. And you need a character that it's not just about that character out of context, but that character in terms of whom will they be reacting to? Who will be bouncing off of whom? And, you know, sort of get dynamics happening between the variety, the character mix.
What are you doing, John?
Can't you tell?
You're holding a quill.
Yes.
You've got some parchment.
Yes.
And you've got some ink.
Yeah, come on. It's obvious, isn't it?
Oh, are you trying to write a novel but making it as difficult as possible for yourself in order to allow a humorous comparison to the easiest way to write a novel, which would be to download Scrivener?
No, actually, I was just trying to write something as timeless and critically lauded as William Shakespeare's stuff. So, I thought I'd use his authentic 1600s kit.
Right, you know what you should probably do, don't you?
Well, stop mincing around and make it a bit easier for myself.
Yeah, download Scrivener. It's got loads of features and tools that'll keep you on the straight and narrow. Helps you plan and edit your novel or non-fiction book, manage your research, link in websites to your notes, even helps you keep on top of any word count targets. It's really, really good.
Well, that does sound good. But, you know, I do want to keep it real.
Look, if old Willie Shakespeare were here right now, the first thing he would do is jump on the internet.
What, and download Scrivener?
No. He'd search up phrases and words invented by William Shakespeare. Then he'd learn all the words and phrases and go back to his time and use them in his plays.
Yeah, and then he'd download Scrivener.
Right, yeah, then he'd download Scrivener.
Wait, wouldn't that mess up the space-time continuum?
No. They've categorically told me downloading their 30-day free trial does not fracture the concept of time and existence as we know it, which I think is a massive plus.
I meant with Shakespeare, you know, with his Macbeth to the future nonsense.
Oh, yeah. Would that mean we'd never get all Shakespeare's contributions to the English language?
I suppose so. But I don't think that really matters. It's much ado about nothing, isn't it?
Did you just make that up? That sounds good, that. It's the stuff that dreams are made of.
Whoa, nice turn of phrase, Tommy. You should write that down.
And you should write down www.literatureandlatte.com, because that's where you'll find the Scrivener free trial. And you can get 20% off the full thing by using the code FAILING. So don't worry about all that time you've wasted messing around with a quill and ink. Just crack on with Scrivener.
Yep. All's well that ends well.
Oh, that's another good, completely original phrase you've come up with there. You're on a roll, mate.
Thanks, man.
Evan, do you have a favourite ever sitcom?
You know,
either you wrote in a if you want to be.
Oh, that I wrote.
I don't know. It could be. I don't know. I guess that.
You know, I actually do. I'll talk about two. The one, my favourite that I wrote. That you'll never see.
Right.
Is it one of the ones that didn't make it?
No, it was produced. Here's the deal. Cool. I was at Fox on a new show, and it was going really well. And I liked the producers, and they liked me. And, it was terrific. And I wrote a script that went over very well. Executives at Fox were coming down to the studio to meet me, which is always a good sign, but never to be trusted. Because I was the flavor of month for 5, maybe 6 weeks, but then our show was canceled before it ever aired. Oh. Why? We had a new executive come in and take over Fox, and she canceled every show in development.
Wow.
And do you know why? There's a logic to it. You know why?
Because
if...
No, go on.
No, John, go.
No, I was going to say, is it because she'd just come in? If they were successful, it wasn't down to her.
Right. And if they were bombs, she'd get blamed.
Yeah.
So so my favorite episode that I wrote was the first episode I wrote for that. And the producers elected to produce my episode before they shot the pilot because they thought my episode did a better job of showing everybody what the show should be than the pilot that sold
the
show.
Come on, get in. So, that's good.
Yeah. So I was pretty pleased by that. And then the show got cancelled. So it's like,
this sounds like there is just an extraordinary amount of waste in TV. You were talking before about there's so many things that get developed and then just get thrown out. What's the percentage of that? Have you any sort of rough idea?
No, but I'm happy to make up numbers. Who's going to tell me I'm wrong?
We're all about that.
Of the shows.
What does it feel like?
The shows that are actually pitched to real people who can actually buy or recommend a show, you know, a small few percentage actually get recommended for further consideration or development. A smaller percentage of scripts that are pitched are actually bought and then put into development. A much smaller percentage actually are produced. Of those produced, a much smaller percentage actually gets on air. Of those that get on, a smaller percentage make it to season two. Yeah.
So by the time we've got down to the bottom, we're on like an eighth of a percent or something.
Yeah, I'll buy that number. Who's going to tell us we're wrong? It's your podcast, and
I'm going to put that on the blog as a definite.
Let's call that a fact.
Absolute fact.
And yet still, there's more available than you could ever possibly hope to watch.
This is a great time to be a TV writer. In fact, you know, I teach TV and film writers, and I tell them, I'm like, if you need to write movies, absolutely work on movies. But if you're on the fence, write for TV. There are hundreds of hours of films produced every year, commercial films, not just, I shot this in my garage, and thousands of hours of TV produced every year. So if you want to be employed, and the TV is so good nowadays. I mean, it's just amazing stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah.
So, but do you think, having said that, like, go for TV, do you think it's easier or harder than ever to get into TV writing?
You know, there are more jobs. People aren't so happy with compensation for a lot of the mid and lower level jobs. You have new media platforms who are hiring people and haven't been forced to pay the same amount, high amounts that a broadcast network like CBS or NBC would pay. But, you know, there are more jobs.
Yeah.
One thing that isn't great is that the business in Hollywood used to be structured such that a new writer would pitch for the chance to write one episode of an existing series. And the Writers Guild of America, the official screenwriting guild, would require every sanctioned series to make one or a couple of episode assignments available every season out of the 22 or 24 that the series might produce. So that was a way for new writers to sort of learn and get a credit and this and that. Now, there's a lot less of that. It's more about you finding your way onto a low-level staff job on the show. So it's like there are more jobs. In a way, it's a little more different.
Right. Yeah.
Agents and managers are not interested in signing clients, generally, not interested in signing clients who don't yet have some credits. Some of them will instead say, well, listen, I'm not going to sign you, but I really love this pilot that you wrote. Let me show it around a little bit. And if something happens with it, you know, then we'll talk. At the least, if we can sell it, I'll represent the show, which benefits you. But I won't necessarily sign you because I have too many clients. I mean,
all these young people that you teach and you're sending into this world, what are the most common mistakes that people make?
That's a good question. I think there's a tendency among some of our young people to go out and be surprised that they don't immediately sell their material and they aren't immediately dubbed a producer at some level. You know, you gotta pay your dues and you gotta keep writing.
Yeah.
One thing I learned when I was working as a writer full time was you never know which script is going to put you over the top for that next job. You know, I had a script or two where I wrote and suddenly it's getting lots of buzz and everyone wants to read it. And everyone my mother knows wants to read it. And then, and then you write something else and you're thinking, this is so good. I am so clever. Look at this. and it's sort of like, so you just have to keep writing. You just have to keep pumping out material.
Yeah.
You know, so people get used to seeing your stuff across their desk and you learn and get better as you go, you know, and you're reading scripts and you're watching shows. I mean, reading scripts, it's so easy now to get copies of Oscar-winning, Emmy-nominated scripts online.
Yeah.
And you need to be reading those. That's a big part of screenwriting courses I teach here. It's like we're reading, you know, I have some classics that demonstrate something a particular way, but other stuff, it's like, okay, this was nominated for an Oscar 2 months ago. We need to read it because it's controversial for some reason. What do you think?
Yeah, one of the things I really like about your book is it's very realistic.
Well, I'm sorry, John. Which book? What was that called?
the book Writing Television Sitcoms.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Evan.
Good book
by Evan S. Smith.
Yeah,
it's written by.
Just check. Is that still available? That's still available.
Yeah,
isn't
it's still available.
It's available in all good bookshops, Dave.
In fact, it's highly recommended that people have two copies.
Yeah.
You really should have one in the bathroom.
Spread
and,
around
you know,
the house.
Just, and then yeah. one. That's always on.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, always in your briefcase, and it makes a heck of a holiday gift. Mm-hmm. I just point that out.
Good Christmas type of book.
No, but it's a very realistic book in a good way.
Well, thank you.
We were talking about it yesterday, actually, weren't we, John? We said it's very kind of it's pragmatic without being too. Some books that are pragmatic, you can read it and think, well, this is all bloody obvious. Like, teach me something. Whereas yours is very pragmatic and down to earth, but you feel like you're picking up a little bit in every single bit. There's always a little,
thank you. That's very kind of you to say.
Yeah, it's laying out the groundwork and it doesn't flatter. It's very
good.
No,
and it doesn't assume that you know stuff. You know, there's always stuff that's passed you by, you know, but whether it's some kind of terminology or some structure of whatever it is. And it is all very nicely laid out and broken down. So well done, Evan. Good book. Well done.
I thank you.
I really like all the jargon of screenwriting. It's always quite fun, you know, learning the lingo of a particular sphere.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you feel like you're in the in crowd.
Yeah.
There's like stuff like gang banging scripts and springboards and buttons and all these things I'd never heard of.
You may
of
have
before.
Different labels for them in but, England, I don't know.
Well, that's true.
You know, so it's
probably
like,
completely different, isn't it? You can just imagine the concerned reactions when an American writer calls out, let's gangbang this bad boy.
You, my dear, dear friend, you're listening to The Failing Writers. Why? Well, that's your business. I'm not here to judge.
In terms of we're just talking about writers in the UK, you kind of hear stories about the British TV writing model being slightly different. Do you know much about that, or is that not something you've ever come across? Or
well, which when you say slightly different, what do you mean?
There's less sort of writing around a table. It tends to be people going away and writing.
Yeah, a bit more of a one-man show rather than...
Yeah, it's a bit more of an individual process.
Yeah, traditional sort of British sitcoms would be like six episodes and they would tend to be written by the same person.
Or maybe a team of two. Yeah, you're going to really expand it out. There might be two people writing it.
Yeah. Because
obviously, the American model has always very much been based around the sort of the writer's room. Writers sat around a table fighting and throwing paper at each other.
Right, so your system is more humane.
Yeah.
And I like it. Yeah, definitely, you know. You know, you can have 12 or 15 writer producers on the show. It's a whole different mix. It's sometimes it's you have five or six, sometimes you have one or two, sometimes you have 10 or 12. On some shows, people are pitching stuff and being sent off to write episodes on their own, then bring it back for notes on rewrites and then bring it back and back and back. Sometimes you'll write something and then they'll hand your episode to someone else who will punch it up. In some shows, they write it from page one as a group. Now, I've never participated in that. I don't know that I'd like that. But the writers are so comfortable with it that literally they are coming up with dialogue for the scenes after they've broken the story and figured it out. They're doing it from page one together. And, I'd like to participate in that. That would be an interesting experience.
Yeah.
But some writers are very comfortable with that.
Evan, we're just talking there about the American versus British thing. And if you cast your mind back 12 minutes, I asked you a question about your favorite sitcom. To draw those two together, do you have a favorite British sitcom?
You know, I always fail this question because when I try and not just the British thing, but when I try and name something, I promptly think of other things that I found just as wonderful. When I was back in high school, Monty Python show, not a sitcom, but that was a great source of amusement for my friends and me. Fawlty Towers on occasion has tickled my fancy. Newer shows. Dairy Girls.
Yes, oh, yes. Good. Yeah.
Now, where's that produced? I don't even know. That's not in England, right?
That's in Northern Ireland. Yeah.
In Ireland. That's a cute show. There's one episode involving a dog or something like that. It's just freaking hilarious. We have to put the subtitles on because, of course, all you people talk you're very funny. Very funny speech. But
Northern Irish can be quite tricky.
But
a little bit. Yeah.
That's another great example because those are like six episodes a series and it's one writer for the whole lot. Right. I guess it's got to be different with the American system when you have like 13 or 20. Four episodes in a series.
Good point, Dave, because it used to be 22 or 24 episodes years ago. Now you might get 8 or 10 episodes or 12 on a streaming network or something.
Yeah, I was going to say, is that like a Netflix? Is that because of the sort of streaming model?
It's spreading. I think the streaming services made that workable, but now it's spreading. And part of it's legitimate because part of it is, you know what? The quality of production has gone up. So, okay, it takes longer. But there are times when I get to episode 8 and they're done and I want 10 more episodes.
Yeah.
You're not doing Game of Thrones where you have to create a chair that stabs people and dragons fly through the air. It's a domestic sitcom. You know, they're in the kitchen. How come you write some more episodes for me, damn it. You know, a show, actually, I rewatched episodes last night with one of my sons, The Peacemaker. Have you seen that?
No.
It's an action. It's a like a Marvel or DC Comics action thing. But you know, there's comedy in it, and it's just hilarious. What We Do in the Shadows. Have you seen that?
Oh yeah,
that's
yeah.
You know, that's there's an episode where they go out on the town with the senior vampire who is visiting them and terrorizing them, and he insists on eating pizza or something, and he's flying through this. You know, really, really good.
The best, Colin Robinson is the most amazing creation in that.
Colin, yes, it's very good.
Just the concept of it. I just think that's such a beautiful thing for someone to have thought of.
And what a lesson there is. You know, you have the first three are almost easier to design, but as a counterpoint, you have this guy who is just so horribly boring that he puts everybody to sleep and he sucks their energy. What's the name of his vampire type? I can't remember.
But Energy Vampire, I think.
Energy Vampire. There you go.
Like
that's a fun, smart show.
Hey, do you ever have an issue with focus? I was going to ask.
Focus
you.
On what?
Well, just focus generally. There's a bit in the book about focus, which I thought was interesting because it says something along the lines of don't get distracted. Writing a film script or a play or a book.
Yeah.
If what you want to do is write sitcoms.
Right.
And you basically go on to say, because while you do, someone else is cranking out scripts for other things and they're getting your work.
Right.
And I think we can relate to that because we all suffer.
Have you done that? What have you written? What have you done that you shouldn't have
well,
done?
We spread ourselves across too many projects at the same time, I think.
Yeah, I mean, just to explain, the reason we started this podcast, Evan, was because we were all fully capable of writing, but we're not really getting around to it at any point in our daily lives. So the idea was to start this podcast to kind of self-flagellate and nag ourselves to actually do something. And it kind of worked. But then by stimulating that and having different guests on, we were starting to write in different little genres and writing poems or writing the start to a thriller book. And then I accidentally wrote a little play the other day. And you know, it just kind of, it's stuff like that. So, so the focus thing.
John already said it, but I'm a big believer in that. I tell my students, you know, at any point in my career, even though I had different careers, I started off as a development executive, then I became a writer, and now I'm a professor. But at any point in my career, I would be the Terminator. And this is the metaphor parallel I draw. You know how the Terminator would come up and you see what he sees and it's like da-da-da-da-da target, you know, and he would go in, he would just zoom.
Yeah.
My attitude is, you know what? It's so hard to get your material read by one type of buyer. Why would you spread yourself thin? I wrote a sitcom script. Well, let me see if I can get those people to read it. Oh, I'm going to write a movie. Let me see if I can get those people to read it. a play. Mm-hmm. Why don't I do something with this play? And while you're working on the other stuff, as I think John said, your competition is writing another sitcom pilot, another sitcom pilot, another sitcom pilot, let alone the idea that, or, you know, not even talking about the idea of them perfecting their craft by working in the craft, because writing a play is not the same as writing a sitcom pilot or a one-hour show or a movie. So, you know, I mean, John Hughes, who wrote, you know, great comedies of the 80s, I guess, I think he had to write 15 screenplays before he finally sold one. And if not, that's the myth I just created, and let's go with it. But I thought I heard that.
Let's make that a fact as well.
Another failing podcast fact.
Very good. Yeah. Worth what you paid for it. There you go. So,
so it's what you're saying is, I think, it's partly a numbers game. Like, you've got to show that you can do one thing incredibly well,
right?
And have versions of that one thing, so that people can go, not sure about that one. I like this one.
But I guess the point is, though, you're doing that to the same group of people, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than reinventing the wheel each time, having to find a brand new group of executives to go and you don't have to do all the legwork every single time.
Mm. Exactly right, Tom, because, you know, it is hard to find who it is you should be going after. It's harder to get them to agree to read your stuff because they spend all day saying no to people. They have an assistant whose job is to screen you out. Even when they take a pitch from you, as I say to my students, you know, generally the pitching approach I suggest to people is you start with the log line or a springboard, which is like a log line on steroids, just to get them to bring down their force field. And then and pay attention and actually maybe ask a question. Then you can go back and pitch a slightly longer version of what you know, then you have a shot. But otherwise, you know, new writers, a lot of people have no interest in listening to what a new writer has to say. And generally they're right, because generally a new writer hasn't yet practiced and perfected their craft enough to bring something to the table, other than the occasional tripped over a fantastic idea.
Yeah.
So I would focus. Now, I've met other professors in the world who say, no, you know, write a play, write an epic poem, you know, great. Most of them have never worked in the business and had to pay their rent based on getting screenwriting.
That's great to feed the soul.
Exactly right.
Right. Exactly. Formats.
Yeah.
I mean, as you sit there eating your dry bread.
They're writing poems, you know, to the chair. Absolutely.
Of course, all this is completely irrelevant, Evan, because this lovely little section I've got in front of me here entitled Ageism. Bessie says, if you're over 40, then find something else to do anyway. So that's kind of...
Tom sent me a screen grab of this the other day, and...
I was really happily reading the book, Evan. I was like, this is good. This has got some good points in it, this. This guy actually knows what he's on about. Look, we're too old.
Well, you know, yes and no.
I don't disagree, Evan. Yeah. I don't disagree.
Yes and no. I mean, nowadays, social media has opened things up a little bit in terms of new opportunities to spread your work. And as long as you don't spread it to the wrong people, then try and steal it.
What we need to do is work on a sitcom about a group of old duffers like us.
Yeah, you know, sure. You're the first to ever think of that. Older people, older writers writing older material. Absolutely. That's never happened.
You're not familiar with Last of the Summer Wine, then, one of the... longest running sitcoms in the
actually I'm not.
You should dig that out and try and watch.
It's called
Try and Watch
Last of the what?
Last of the Summer Wine, and it's basically three old blokes. The joke in this country is that Last of the Summer Wine is basically three old blokes that end up going down a field in a bath.
Yeah,
that's accurate, isn't it?
It's
one of the classic moments of British.
It's a continuing series.
It's the longest running. It was the longest running British sitcom in history.
Going down a field in a bath.
three men in a bath, basically.
With it's always the bloke who wears his trousers are held up by a piece of string is usually in the bath.
Okay.
While one of them frowns while it happens, and the other one had a big idea for it to happen, it's all gone wrong.
Well, you know, here, let me make a note.
I apologize.
No more podcasts.
Yes.
No, you know what? The world has changed a little bit, and it used to be very much, because think about it. If you have a 27-year-old showrunner, do they really want to be giving notes to a 40-year-old guy sitting at the other end of the table? They feel uncomfortable doing it generally. No. And network executives who sometimes maybe don't know a lot are always going to make the assumption that only the youngest person showing up in front of their desk is equipped to bring fresh ideas and current content. You know, it's a prejudice, it's a bias, it's human nature. What are you going to do? It doesn't mean you shouldn't write, you know, and I would bet that in England, you have a far better shot at getting heard for that type of thing than in the US. But you know what? There are also a lot of opportunities to enter your writing into like the better screenwriting contests and stuff where it's evaluated more objectively before they realize that you're 45 and say, lose my number. Yeah. You know, well, maybe they realize you're 45 and say, nah, keep my number. Let's talk about the project. Now, most of the screenwriting competitions out there are not worth the money they take from you. But there are some that are good where they actually expose your material to the right people. And, you know, so you really have to do your homework and make sure that it's not just
they lead to things.
Friends, house of screenplays, send me $80 and I guarantee you that I will spend that money. You know, it's you got to do your homework on that.
You, my dear, dear friend, are listening to The Failing Writers. Why? Because even the most successful writers in the world are failing a little bit.
So, nitty-gritty time, Evan. The three of us are currently in the process of writing an original sitcom, or at least we're trying to write a sitcom. I think my first observation is it's really hard, isn't it, to write a sitcom?
How do you guys write it? How do you develop it? What's your process?
Well, that's a good question.
Well, this is the thing. This is also our first attempt at actually writing something together.
Yeah.
So we were having a go at sort of collaborative writing and trying to focus on one project.
Mm-hmm.
But actually getting us all together in the same place, even virtually, is proven to be pretty difficult.
Yeah.
So we have been kind of doing it, like, you know, sort of individually and then bringing things together. But we've had a couple of meetings recently where we've actually tried doing stuff all at the same time. And it's remarkably effective.
It went well.
We did. We had a breakthrough meeting last night, didn't we? And there was an awful lot of,
And
then noises, you wake up this morning, my ideas were great, but those other two guys, that stuff was shit.
How do you find collaborating, Evan? You must have collaborated with
lots of people. I was not successful at it. I have one of my lifetime best friends, another writer named Bob, and we're like, you know, he's a writer, I was a writer, we're both in LA, finally, because every time I'd moved to New York, he moved to LA, and we ended up in the same city. It's like, let's do it, put something together. So we got together on the roof of his apartment building, he smoked cigars, we sat in comfortable chairs, we had our laptops out or whatever, and we proceeded to entertain ourselves wonderfully for 3 hours and not get anything decided and written. And realize that, you know, it's like we had a great time, but that was not a partnership that worked because we just, you know, we were more interested in having fun and talking. Now, one of my most successful former students is a writer named Michael Weber, and he's an Oscar-nominated screenwriter, and he writes with a partner. And they've got a very successful system where, you know, they start together, I guess they start ideas, and then they divide up. They divide up the work, go work on their stuff, and then they trade stuff, work on it, and move to the next step, and move to the next step. So your breakthrough experience last night might empower you to find a pattern where you actually are able to be productive and move forward. And, you know, I would try and build on that because breakthrough, that's a good word.
I think you're right. Yeah.
But you need to bring discipline to the process. Yeah. And I would say, you know, okay, so especially with Three Minds, it's like, don't go to an outline until you've created a beat sheet. Of course, you may just be still talking about the series overall. How far are you in this project?
We've just created the outline without doing a beat sheet. we've just done that. That's what we've just done.
Okay, so Tom, I'm not talking to you anymore. Because I'm telling you that you want, especially with Three Brains, I would not skip that beat sheet step. Because if it doesn't make sense on one piece of paper, where you can see this leads to this, leads to this, leads to this, you know, then you might not see where it doesn't make sense in an outline and then the script is going to be flawed by default. So I'm a big fan of doing that step.
I think that's our next step, isn't it?
I think I need to reread the beat sheet thing. I'm not sure I entirely understand it. I think it's like the big moments, isn't it? Is that right?
It platforms, yeah. You know, I also wrote an article on it. I do a column for Script Magazine, which is the Writer's Digest screenwriting website. If you type Evan Smith comedy, you'll go there. And there's an article, I forget what it's titled because I only wrote it. So, every story deserves a good beating. Go read that if you want a quick primer.
Oh, yeah, cool.
On you know, that it's not painful to read, really. And
yeah,
it's worth your time. I promise you, in my writing classes, that's a step I make the students take every time. It's more work for me because I have to read the stuff, but you know, it's important, you know.
Well, I think that's our sort of next stage. I think what we actually had a breakthrough with last night is finally working out what the hell it is that we're writing, what it's about.
Well, sitcom. So, you know, first step is what's the show? And then once you have a sense of what the show is, then you back up and say, okay, what's the pilot episode? Now you're writing a script. Until you reach that second part, it's all about you're structuring the creative universe for the show, the world of the show, the character mix. So, you know, step one before, you know, here's where I think you might benefit from that discipline thing I mentioned. Don't let yourself go to the next step until you're really happy with what you've accomplished. Because then you'll just jump to this, you'll jump to that, you'll jump to that. You'll end up with something written, but it won't be your best stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I like one of the big problems that we've had, I think, because we've tried to sort of use the use lessons from our guests throughout the series to sort of inform what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And we've kind of got ourselves into a bit of a muddle. Maybe you can sort of add some clarification to this of like the difference between a sitcom and a comedy drama series. And we've been sort of blurring the lines and not really sort of... been able to decide if what we're doing actually is a sitcom or if it's a comedy drama.
Yeah, and that's a standard problem. It's like, what level and tone of comedy are we going to adopt? And we have to be consistent with that from episode one to episode 100.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely super important. And it used to be, sometimes people refer to it as a dramedy. It used to be that dramedies meant that the people had written a script. It wasn't funny enough to be a comedy or exciting enough to be a drama. So they're like, it's a dramedy, you know, and most dramedies were inherently horrible. But then with streaming services, I think empowering or enabling or leading to a higher level of writing, partly because shows could be serials where you just build on stuff. It's not all episodic where you got to make it all happen one time. That's a conscious decision. How funny do you want it to be? Or how much do you want to be leaning into drama? I mean, you need to make, that's a discussion.
I think that's the discussion that we've been having for a very long time now.
You know what might help you to make the decision is if you come up with in your discussions, and I bet you have, examples of scenes that you might see in this series.
Yeah.
You know, look at those scenes. Are those scenes inherently funny? Or are they dramatic with only like a little leavening of humor, a little, you know, it ends with a clever comment. Or comedy always comes from one character in particular. When they come in, you know, I sold a cop show episode once because I knew they wanted to work with a comedian, Gilbert Gottfried, who unfortunately just passed.
Yeah.
And I'd been given a tip that the producers wanted to work with him again. So when I pitched ideas for an episode, I was like, oh, and in this episode, the two stars are saddled with the world's worst witness played by someone like, I don't know, Gilbert Gottfried.
Sold.
Within 10 seconds, sold. Exactly right. So it's like, you know, so that's part of the big picture you're looking at, which is, okay, we're interested in writing comedy. Where's the comedy going to come from? You know? Because if you create a premise, a series premise that's all very serious, this and that, you can have comedy, but it's probably going to be just, I don't know, clever asides between characters who are occasionally spar, this and that, maybe entertaining secondary characters who add a little levity. You know, that's cool. That works.
Yeah.
Or if you want something where it's in your face funny, you want something that's very funny in terms of how wonderfully it reflects human frailties and screw-ups. That's fun. Mm. You know, think about what you want. And then here's my, you talked about focus earlier. Here's my thought, a derivative of that. Make your best guess on what you think it should be now. Go write it, knowing that when you see the finished product, if you don't like it, you can back up and change it.
But when
you get to the outline phase, if you're like, this outline thing, it's exciting, but we've kind of seen this elsewhere. It's not making me laugh, or it's not what I want. Then back up and fix it at the story level before you go to write the script, because you can always force jokes into a script, but that's not what we want to do, right?
Yeah.
For me, I think it's currently, and I might be talking out of turn here, but currently it feels like bang in the middle of a sitcom and a comedy drama.
I would tend to agree with that. I think it's probably got one foot slightly further in the sitcom. Mm,
yeah.
Just from what everyone was saying there about, if we're voicing out scenarios and scenes, we've gone straight to,
we're looking for the funny.
There's a funny because there's a, rather than it just literally just driving the narrative, and then,
but there kind of is a character and a story arc as well in a sort of comedy drama type way.
But I think that's fine, isn't it? It can be between the two. There's not a hard line. I think that's where we got ourselves tied.
I think I've got a touch of post-traumatic stress when we talk about our sitcom. Because the last time we talked to a sitcom expert on the show, it was the experience was difficult.
How?
I think partly because we were struggling to verbalize what the hell our idea was about. That was probably partly why.
Well, we haven't even gone there yet. And if you want to, we can in a second. But I would say, as long as the story, primarily the story in the pilot, is compelling, it's interesting. It's got a couple of turns in it. Maybe it's got a surprise. Maybe it's got a surprise at the end to leave us wanting to come back to episode two, as long as the story is fresh and compelling, it's dramatic enough probably for what you want.
Yeah.
You don't want to duplicate story types that you can see on three other shows currently.
No, it's only on one or two shows, so that's good. Yeah.
Three is the number. You're good. Everybody knows that.
We're in the Goldilocks zone. Yeah, cool, cool.
That's a good.
We've only copied off one or two things.
Hey, Dave, do you want to give Evan our series logline, seeing as you wrote it or you finished
it? Yeah, okay. All right. Yeah, we've been working on this, but we were trying to, because as John said, the last time we spoke about it to a guest, we really struggled to even sum up what the hell any of it was about. So we thought, right, let's try and get some sort of logline in place. Just to give her an impression.
Question. Do you want to do this on air? Or are you going to edit this out? I mean, you're sharing your idea. You're happy to share your idea?
Sure. No.
Yeah, we'll share.
Because you can't.
That's okay.
You can't copyright an idea. I might take your idea.
No one's going to be stupid enough to decide.
No,
Evan.
All right, go ahead.
We're safe.
You take it, Evan. Make it happen.
Okay. So where we got to after our breakthrough meeting yesterday was. A long-running, lads-only poker night is shaken when a leaving member announces his replacement is a woman. As the men struggle to adapt, firmly held beliefs are questioned, toilet habits irrevocably changed, vulnerabilities and secrets unraveled, but the new girl has the biggest secret of all.
Okay.
That's where we got to today.
So let's think of one line at a time. Go do the first line. So I'm going to be blunt with you, or do you want me to?
No, please, go.
I can, no, I be can blunt. Lie. We want blunt. Okay, we want blunt trauma.
So the very first
bit of it, a long-running lads-only poker night is shaken when a leaving member announces his replacement is a woman.
Okay.
So it's about a woman coming into a lads-only.
Got it.
Thing.
Got it. So my first thoughts are, okay, that event probably happening in the pilot is a lot of fun. Absolutely. What happens in episode 6? What happens in episode 22? What happens in episode 62? Because a woman isn't going to come in and shake up their world in every episode of the series.
No, that is true.
So we're talking about legs for the show. So just starting from that, let's have a conversation.
Yep.
So where do you see this show going from this interesting little shakeup that you created in the pilot? What happens in those future episodes? One at a time.
Well, go, John.
No, I think I think you should take this one, Dave, because this ultimately is it's yours. It belongs to you. Come on.
Well, yeah, so obviously, like you rightly said, the woman only is a sort of surprise once. The rest of it really is about the sort of relationships between the sort of different characters and the way they kind of adapt to having this sort of new person in the group.
So can you get 30 or 40 or 60 episodes
well,
out of that?
Well, probably not, no. But we're doing this, we're taking a British approach on this and saying, right, 6 episodes.
And just doing 6.
Yeah, to begin with here.
I suppose yeah, you're thinking,
you know,
Dave,
what?
Originally.
You're absolutely right. You're right. You know what? You're absolutely right. Let's talk about it as a limited series.
Yeah.
For 6 or 8 episodes.
I suppose Dave's thought early on, in a sense, was about, it's sort of about the character mix. So if you think of a sitcom like Friends, mm-hmm. and what that's ultimately about, it's about a group of friends. What else is it about? It's about a group of friends whose live, yeah. I mean, it's not that easy to talk about.
But it has to be in a pitch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the executive's going to ask, okay? So an executive's going to ask just what producer, just what I asked, which is what happens in the subsequent episode. So it's not 40 or 60, it's 6 or 8 episodes. Absolutely. You know, so, okay. So, and you're going to have this thing happen in the pilot episode, right?
Yeah.
I assume.
Yeah.
Because it's what gets people to tune into episode 2. You can't really not have that. I don't think.
Yeah.
So you got 5 more episodes. What happens in the next 5 episodes?
Well, she has infiltrated the group on purpose. She is under the misapprehension that this is a high stakes poker game, because one of the guys that's in the poker game is a Billy Bullshitter. He's, do you know what I mean? So he's built it up like this is a massive thing. And it's not. It's just a group of people that are barely friends, but they do get together every week. And they have done, and they hold this poker group as a big part of their lives. They're not kinds of people that have a lot of friends. Yeah,
there's not much going on in their lives. Lonely people,
and this is a bit of a magnet for them. So this woman has come in thinking she can make some quick money because we haven't quite decided why she needs the money yet, but quite possibly one of her family is in trouble with some gangsters or something that may be linked into it. So she thinks she can get some quick money, and she can't. As it turns out. John, what happens next?
We're not entirely sure what happens next, are we, if we're being completely honest? But
the idea is, isn't it, that so she's trying to basically pull a fast one on them and take all their money. They discover this, but by that time, episode 3/4, there's a relationship's being built, and actually they quite like each other. And our male poker players then somehow team together, don't they, to pool money so that Malky, the bullshitter, who pretended that he once won a massive poker tournament, but he didn't, he was lying, which we know as the audience, but the poker players don't know, has to go in episode 6, is in a high-stakes tournament to try and win the money that will stop the gangsters from kneecapping her brother.
So I thought you did a good job of vamping through to create a narrative to take us through the 6 episodes. The charm of the pitch is back at the beginning. It's these nerds, sort of losers or whatever, who have this thing, and she comes in to shake up their world. You sort of then took a left turn and went towards and chased the money. And that could work. What interested me more was the shakeup of their world part of it, where suddenly there's this woman. You have her be a shark. She's come in to get money from them. Yeah, I guess the problem is if she's a shark, then once she realizes they don't have money, she's gone, right? Why would she stay? None of them is exciting enough to make her stay. So the shark thing, okay, I'm going to back up. Talk about who the protagonist is. You can't, if she's just there as a device, dramatic device, a shark who comes in and maybe takes all their money, and then they're like, what do we do? You know, you signed away your car. You know, we got basically robbed. She's a shark. And then you pursue that, them trying to get justice or something. That's that's a story. That's an option. Getting kneecapped by mobsters, I don't know that you need to go all that way, but that's a story too, where you come to find out that, you know, in following her after she wipes them out, these nerds find themselves sort of tripping into this higher level situation. Why they're able to enter a high stakes poker game when apparently they don't have the skills, I'm not quite sure how that works. That's a story logic question.
Yeah.
You know, because you haven't told me that one of them is like super, super good at yep. this stuff. You know, it's almost like if you were going to have someone be turn out to be super, super good at poker, that the group needs to save them. It's almost like it should be the woman. And in that version of the story, it's not that she's a shark. It's that she likes to play. She got invited in. She beats them. And then they're like, you know, find themselves in an odd circumstance where they need to turn to this person they haven't maybe been so nice to, that they're learning from, and they need her to rescue them
yeah.
from other male chauvinist males or something.
So they have the problem and she's the hero.
She becomes the hero and they learn to be better men through associations with her. Mm. And hell, if you want, throw in a romance. Is one member of the poker party, you know, does he become connected with this person? Mm. You know? So I'm rambling. I'm just tossing out stuff based on what you want.
I think the last 4 minutes has done more than the last 4 months. So that's fine, to be honest.
Yeah, because our original idea is that all of the characters kind of have secrets, being resolutely real men. They all have secrets that they're not telling each other because, you know, they're kind of playing a game. They're all trying to be sort of high status to a certain extent. They're all putting up a facade.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the idea, in a way, was that she came in and began to kind of break them down.
She was the catalyst that would come in. Yeah,
that's it. Exactly.
Teach them how to get in touch with their feminine side.
Yeah.
and be honest.
And
be nice.
Be
to
honest
each
with each other. Yeah.
That almost sounds like an interesting play. You know, where you could almost see it like a one set play or something. In three acts, but we're not writing plays, we're writing shows.
We're not writing plays.
I mean, we could do
so. No, dude, you're forbidden from writing any plays. I didn't think I'd do this podcast, that was my mission all along. Last thing I want to do is squash any creative energy you have that might well drive you towards a very successful narrative thing. So, I'm trying to be encouraging in saying, options on her character. You've talked about her being a shark. That can work. They deal with the shark, maybe learn from the shark, maybe eventually form an alliance, reluctant alliance with the shark, and deal with some third party that's a threat or danger or a target of her. Another is that she's not, that, you know, but that she is like either a good person, maybe a more successful down to earth person than them, and she just is really good at cards. And they end up having to accept her, and maybe they need her help to get out of a situation. Mm. I don't know. Back to what you first pitched, the idea of this. I do like the open of the premise, which is these guys, suddenly there's a woman sitting across the table. That's good. That's intriguing.
Yeah.
I'm just not sure. You know, it's like I have to sort of slow down because I don't want to muddle. Tell me more about where you saw the story going. I'm going to back up. Okay. This woman comes in. Why does she get to come in?
Well,
I know that the person leaving has sent her.
Yeah. So the original thing before we went down the sort of shark route is that she had somehow discovered that. It was kind of like a sort of MacGuffin thing. So there was like a trophy that every year this kind of winner of this poker night gets to have a trophy. And she somehow heard this rumor that this trophy that they've got is worth some money. So she's kind of infiltrated the group in order to try and get her hands on that thing. And she kind of has to stay in the group rather than it being like she's just winning money off them. She has to sort of stay with the group. Because they go to each other's houses, that like the poker night is at a different location every week, so they sort of rotate between the houses. So she has to go to each of those locations to try and find this thing. Yeah, so that's kind of how it originally started.
Wouldn't she, Dave, within 5 minutes of sitting across the table from these guys, wouldn't she quickly divine that they are not what she thought they were from them acting like the nerds that they are?
Yeah, well, I think that's why we kind of originally thought that these guys can't know that this thing that they've got is actually valuable in any way. And then we were trying to think, well, maybe should it just be valuable in terms of money? Or so that this is where we've been sort of going round and round in circles of, mm-hmm. is finding a reason for her to, as you say, finding a reason for her to keep coming back, for her to be there for every episode once she realizes that they're a bunch of nerds, as you said.
I agree. That's a problem. It's like, you know, I don't know that I have the answer off the top of my head. You know? Yeah. It's a good struggle. Mm. Good for you.
Yeah.
We've been struggling for a while.
I don't know whether to feel better, Evan, because you haven't got a clue. So that makes us think, well, we shouldn't have had a clue either. Or whether we should feel bad that we've woven such a mess of narrative that actually the funniest thing about our sitcom is the way we've gone about it, is our method. It's hilarious.
But that's the thing, like the real, you know, the beginning part of it is that all of the humour, all of the funnies is just about this group of misfits who shouldn't necessarily be together, getting together every week and playing poker. And the kind of MacGuffin or the shark part of it is something that we've added to try and make it into a bigger story arc.
We shouldn't.
No, I think you need a story. What you're describing with these guys, and then you have the inciting incident where this woman shows up. Is her name one of these ambiguous names like Leslie or something, or Sam? It's a Samantha. They think it's a Sam, it's a guy or something.
Yep.
So if you wanted to play that joke.
Yep.
But that's the setup. But you do need a story. You got six episodes to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you were, you know what a log line is. So forget the one you've written. I'm not saying to lose it. I'm just saying, if you were to describe the story component of the six episode series, what would it be? You know, a bunch of nerds and a talented female poker player go up against blank, blank, blank because either they do that or, you know, in order to accomplish such and such. Or that's like sort of the big shark, you know. It could be shark. It could just be that she's anti-shark, but she's got the talent, you know. And then they need her and they recruit her because they've got a need, you know. Do they... I guess I don't know how poker tournaments are structured. You don't have four people play as a part of a poker tournament. So she couldn't be part of a poker team. I guess they don't do that. So I'm creating new card games in my head that will soon be sweeping the land. You've got a good setup. You know, I'd say it is worth your working on it, but you're, I think, making a mistake if you think it's enough to settle for the fun situations and dialogue that would happen from this woman and these three guys or
what
four
if
guys.
She, I think is,
what
yeah.
if she
three or four guys?
Does what if she does persuade them to raise the stakes of the game? Because she needs this money for whatever the reason is, her daughter then needs, you know, some treatment if she needs the money,
you know. Sorry. John, your instinct is right to try and justify her motive by giving her a need so that she has her character appeal increases. That's one way. You don't have to go that way. She could be a user too, you know. Here's a thought, and anything we talk about, you know, if I accidentally trip over some little thing you want to use it with you. You know, what if you start off this thing where she comes in, plays innocent, scams them, and they're like, and they confront her, and then she's like, well, you know, it's a thing, you know, you can do it. You say you need money, blah blah blah. What if she trains them, and it's like they become Oliver Twist and Fagin, you know? What if she becomes a female Fagin? And next thing you know, these three nerds and the shark that's entered their life, you know, next thing you know, they're like getting involved. You want to have them get involved with like mob level stuff, and they're playing for, they used to play for $20 stops. But you know, then you have, okay, the twist is she reluctantly, they're like, hey, I'm not sure how you handle this. I do know it could be handled,
where suddenly she's like, you're saying you need money, blah, blah, blah. You're not getting my money back. I want that money from you. You want money, you know, maybe she needs them for her next scam. Is she kind of a scammer? And so gradually, next thing you know, these people who live, play cards in their basement are like being trained into scammers. And next thing you know, they're like pulling off stuff. Maybe something backfires and they scam the wrong person. And now they're in trouble. Yeah. And now, you know, so it's like, you can take it from small, comfortable, world shaken up a little bit. But then when you take one part her and three parts them and put them together, chaos ensues, that horrible thing.
Yeah.
But where she trains them and they, you know, and then you're building up to, I mean, this really becomes one of those, it's like it becomes almost a heist type of story, where at the end, it's like the stakes are high. Maybe you've got a romantic thing between one of the people and her. You don't have to, or maybe you do. And then at the end, I'm not sure where they end up broke and ruined, but now they're different people.
Yeah.
Now they're more, like now they're leaving the basement because it's like, they got shit to do. You know, it's like, why do I wait? You know, this is, or successful and living large at the end because, you know, they've basically, with her help, won the lottery.
Yeah.
Do you think that's sounding more like a sort of movie screenplay? Or do you think that's a
good question. That could be a 2-hour movie. I could also see this being.
Hey, let's write a screenplay.
Focus, Tom.
That's a good one. But no, I think that would fly as a 6-hour thing. I'd be tuning in to see, well, what sort of trouble are they in there?
I like that.
You know?
I suppose it's all in the characters, isn't it? If you can draw more out.
Well, they start out as losers pretending thinking they're in some sort of high stakes thing. And then they turn into real high stakes.
And then realize they're in deep, deep shit. And, you know, but somehow.
Call her Billy Fagan.
Yeah. And that's. Somehow they pull it together and survive.
This is good, Evan. This is almost like you've done this before a few times. And we're going to get an invoice.
No. If anything we said actually served you, I'm delighted. Go do it. But, you know, but if you sell this thing at some point, let me know. I'd just applaud you.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely stay by the phone, Evan. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you see, this idea already has more legs than the old one. You can see where it goes next.
I think I'd watch it.
Yeah.
You know.
Good.
But, you know, so go write that. Go write it. No writing more plays. Who wrote a play? Tom, you wrote a play?
Dave wrote a play too, Evan. It wasn't just me. Dave wrote one as well.
What's the name of the show? What's the name of it? You have a title?
It's called Poker Night.
Poker Night. Poker Night.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Poker Night work.
Can I just ask one sort of last question, Evan? The whole point of this series, what we're trying to build up to, it turns out John's got a friend who works in the industry. So we're building up, once we've written this, to actually kind of put a pitch together which we'll do on the show. So do you have like one tip for it, when you're standing in front of that TV exec and you've got your pitch ready for like just to really make it sort of sing when you're in front of that exec?
Well, actually, you know what? Review the book because I talk about it a lot in the book and it's exactly pretty much like what you're talking about, which is what do you do to prepare the pitch and how do you go in? So, you know, and the basic technique I mentioned at the top of the show, which is, you know, a quick pitch to catch their interest, that refined log line. And then, you know, you'll have a chance to give maybe a one-page description of what the series is. I guess the other thing I'd say is this. You should not only write the pilot, you should have a series Bible. You know what that is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you need a series Bible, you know, 10, 15, 20 pages that describes where the series goes. And because you have the pilot script would be episode 1, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But you're also going to be talking about episodes 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Yeah.
You know, so there are examples of series Bibles on the internet. Maybe do a little reading on that. I talk about it only minimally in the book, and you know, it would be smart for you to have that ready too.
Sure,
sounds good.
Right,
because they're going to ask, you know, right, this is the pilot. What happens in episodes 2, 3, 4, 5, 6? So you need to know.
And then we'll tell them.
Yeah.
We'll tell them. So they're on this hill, in a bath.
That's right. Okay, so
these old guys.
Dave and John, you're leaving Tom at home when you set up the kid.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's right.
I think they'd already decided that, but yeah. Evan, thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm going to run.
We have taken loads of your time.
Thank you so much.
Aware of that. Really kind of.
I've enjoyed it. It's been great.
Yeah, we really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much for joining us.
All right, are we done? Am I saying goodbye? Am I hanging up?
No, you hang up.
Goodbye, guys. Goodbye.
Like a phoenix rising from the ashes, Evan S. Smith has made our fires burn. We were drowning, but now we're mounting our return. Just pray God, old dogs can learn.
I don't know about you chaps, but that was possibly the most useful interview that we've had, I think, just in terms of our own sort of devices.
Yeah. I felt there was a bit at the end there where he kind of extinguished our flame of ambition and keenness, but with the other hand, immediately relit it.
Yeah.
It was almost one movement.
It was. He utterly doused us for a moment.
Yeah, but then just reignited that spark.
Do you know, I think one thing that we've got to get much better at when it comes to actually doing this pitch is when someone asks
pitching,
but when someone asks us a question, we actually have to be able to answer it rather than just going,
And don't just go, so Dave, over to you.
There really was.
There was a lot of passing of the book there, wasn't there?
I particularly like the bit where you said, where Dave said, so John, and John went, no, Dave, basically.
Somebody answer this
you
question.
You take the hot potato.
I think I heard Evan sigh at one point.
Hey, he was a nice guy, wasn't he?
What a genuinely lovely chap.
He was very nice about the fact that we were utterly useless. So
you can see why he's a professor, can't you? He's a professor of writing stuff.
A learned man. Yeah.
He knows his stuff.
So thank you very much, Evan. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, genuinely, thank you.
Thanks for doing for us what we have been unable to do for ourselves.
We're going to have to put him in the writing credits now, aren't we?
But, I think we will. Yeah. Right at the top.
Maybe, like on the inside cover of a book where it says, you give your acknowledgements and it will say,
yes.
To Evan S. Smith, who without his help, this project wouldn't have been possible. .. No, literally. No, seriously.
Literally none of this would have happened.
we were sailing off into confused land, and he really did just clarify what we should be doing.
So, but then who knew? Who knew that talking to experts is the best way to learn?
I'm still not sure. I mean,
depends on the expert, to be fair.
Be coincidence.
You know what they say about experts, don't you?
What do they say?
An ex is a has-been and a spurt is a meaningless dribble.
Oh, all right, yeah.
I don't know who says that.
Probably the same person that came up with, what assume does and things like that, isn't it? And there's no I in team. Another such fascinating workplace.
At the centre of life. Is an if.
Isn't that Chad? Didn't Chad come up with them?
He may have done.
Chad Nardworthy.
Yeah.
I think he came up with them.
I think he probably came up with one about Scunthorpe, to be honest.
But that was a long interview. It was a good interview, but it was a long interview. So we've probably just about got time to first of all say, don't forget, if you don't win a copy of Scrivener with our competition, you can get 20% off the Scrivener software by using the code failing.
And it is an excellent, in fact, I would go as far as to say it is an invaluable bit of software.
It is brilliant. I think you can use it and it's amazing, and then you realize you're probably only using like 20 or 30% of its potential of what it does. Whatever you need it to do in terms of formatting a book and keeping bits of research or anything, it's all set up to use, isn't it?
I think
whatever you need it to do.
Keeping in line with a lot of the facts that Evan came up with in that interview, I think it's safe to say 100% of all the best-selling books ever written have been written on Scrivener.
I think
that's a fact. That's a fact now, isn't it?
Let's go with it.
You should pick like an 89% or something like that. Then it's...
Yeah, that's cool.
189%.
189%, 189% of all decent books.
Yeah. Have written on Scrivener.
Written on Scrivener.
Yeah.
It's a failing writers podcast fact.
But the only other thing we've got time to say, really, is goodbye, I think.
Is it?
Yeah.
So, thank you for listening.
don't have time to say that, John. Just goodbye.
Have I got time to say goodbye?
No.
Oh.